Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language. Here are your hosts, Mo, Michael, and Tim.
Hi, everybody. This is the Analytics Power Hour, and this is episode 204. You know, the use of data to transform decision-making and business outcomes, that's certainly something we all believe in. And the methods involved in doing this are many. And you might have heard of the idea of data as a product before. And should all of our data be a product? Or what does that even mean? Well, we're going to explore that thought in a lot more detail in this episode. Let me bring in my two co-hosts. Mo Kiss, do you use any data products?
I am starting to dabble, yes.
I know. Well, you presented on this topic at the Marketing Analytics Summit this past summer, so I'm sure you've got some relevance for you.
It's very near and dear to my heart, yes.
And Tim Wilson, how are you, sir?
Good. My middle name is Data Product, actually.
Oh, Tim Data Product Wilson. I love it. Then I'm Michael Hobling. All right. Well, we needed a guest. Someone with some experience on this topic. Eric Weber is a senior director of data science at Stitch Fix. He has 15 years of experience working in and teaching others about data. Prior to Stitch Fix, he's held numerous data science and experimentation roles at companies like Yelp, LinkedIn, many others. His newsletter, From Data to Product, is excellent. And today he is our guest. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you.
My middle name is not data product, so I feel like I'm behind.
Not yet.
Could change.
Well, you know, there's a new king of England, so he might start off by just knighting a bunch of people, so you could become Sir Data Product, maybe. I don't know.
Does that allow me to retire?
I don't know. Anyway, we're very excited to have you on the show. Mo has talked about you and your conversations together quite a bit. And so I think maybe to get us kicked off, maybe just tell us a little bit about what you do and your role and some of the things you write about, and then we'll jump into the conversation.
I think the best way to think about my role at Stitch Fix is maybe to just think more broadly about consumer-facing products. And I think this is, you know, back to your point about, like, we talk about decision science and making better decisions and setting up businesses to do that. The reality is it's like, it's really, really hard to do because you have people making these decisions and not, you haven't automated them away. My role is to focus on how to create, like, reusable tools, platforms, capabilities that at least remove some of the pain of making these choices and decisions. Certainly one of those areas is in experimentation, trying to actually establish some degree of causality so that when someone says why, you actually have a reasonable answer. But there's a whole bunch of adjacent things you can do to that where, you know, whether it be through like causal inference or even like really thoughtful analytics, and like we can get to that later. Analytics is such a tough term, but done in the right way, you can still make a lot of thoughtful, reasonable choices, understanding risk one way or the other. And my team's focus on building those capabilities. And in some cases, those come in the form of like internal user-facing products. In other cases, there's a lot of just like technical architecture behind the scenes. So Stitch Fix, like a lot of companies, is trying to leverage technology to innovate. And, you know, as you see experimentation crop up across many different companies, people keep asking, like, why haven't we just built like one product that does it for all these companies? The reason is that each company is fairly different in how they make choices, and very few of them are comfortable outsourcing that to a third-party product.
I've been reading your blog for a really long time, and anyone who has spent any time with me at a conference or in the office knows that this is a topic I've really been kind of going deep on and reading pretty widely. And yeah, it's fair to say that you and your blog were a big inspiration for me in kind of going down this path about data products. But what triggered it for you? Like, what made you start? Because like, you write about it pretty often, and you can, like, I've, in my conversations with you, have seen you, that your thinking has been shaped over time.
Yeah.
Where are you drawing from?
I wish I had a great answer, other than I had enough conversations where the gist of it was we kept talking about these companies that just had, like, essentially internal graveyards of stuff they had built and then discarded. And they were like, we have a lot of stuff that we're not using. We probably paid a ton of money to produce those things. And I think it's more a question of, like, was that necessary? Like, could we do it differently? Could we do it better? Could we have actually thought about, you know, our approach to building these things? And with how data science came onto the scene, like, it came onto the scene through, in some cases, just using old, like, SQL databases that people were like, oh, I'm going to do new things with. Or in some cases, it was starting to write code in R or Python. So you just got all of these things, like, tossed together all at once. And it was kind of almost okay in the name of, like, we're investing in data science. I think now we're at a point where a lot of companies are asking the right questions around, is this worth it for us? What does it mean to actually do this the right way? And so to me, it's actually, like, trying to be a bit more responsible with, what do we build? Why do we build it? Should we continue to invest in it? And I had enough of these conversations that I was like, I should write. I like writing. And at that point, I had no other idea, like, okay, Substack seems right. And that's, it's like one day I just sat down and started doing it. And I think what keeps it going is that I get feedback from people that actually just, like, changes how I think about things. It challenges some of the assumptions that I have. And that's pretty rewarding because it ends up actually benefiting me at work to be like, oh, I should do this differently or think about this differently. Or, oh, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And, like, that's often a good experience when someone can teach me that.
So as you were saying that these things get built and then they kind of wind up in the graveyard of, like, we invested a lot in this, but they're not getting adopted. Like, I can't help but think back to, like, the data warehouse boom it feels similar that there was a time where, when, like, an earlier wave of organizations wanting to use their data, realizing not really a good idea to just be writing queries against production systems, the data is not in good format, they put them in data warehouses. But there was this, a lot of hand wringing back in the late 90s, early aughts, of, like, we keep building data warehouses and we think that's going to be the answer. And then the data warehouses kind of died on the vine as well. And it seems like, from, is, if I understand a lot of what you talk about with kind of data as product, it was a similar symptom. It was kind of the myth of, if we build it, they will come, which, I mean, is that fair? And is there also a risk that even with data science, people are like, if I throw a bunch of Python at this stuff, or if I stand up the ability to build a model, they will come? And what gets missed is, no, wait a minute, what are we doing? How do we need to do it effectively and efficiently? Who's using it? And is that the miss?
I think that seems right. In terms of the miss, I mean, what I'm writing about now probably could apply to many other periods where companies go through some period of innovation and a new set of tools. Like, if you thought about, like, when everyone in maybe 2010 or 2011 was like, Hadoop is going to be the thing that changes everything, so we need to definitely go that direction. And now it's like, who would do that? It doesn't make sense. So I think it's, like, maybe part of it is just, can we, like, I should not assume that data science and, like, a lot of these tools are the last time we're going to kind of go through this explosive change. I think it's a question of, like, 5 years from now, is there a way for us to actually plan or think through what we're investing in so that we don't end up with in the same position where we're like, we have a whole bunch of stuff, we might not need it. because honestly, it impacts like maybe even more so in a major way, like the cost of data science, especially a lot of modeling. Like it has a real tangible cost that shows up on the balance sheet in a way that like is very obvious. And the more we can get ahead of that, I think the better.
And the funny thing, I think, I actually was having a conversation about this yesterday, exactly about the cost, like how do we know when, say, like a machine learning model should be deprecated? And we were having this conversation with a senior data scientist, was like, well, you just compare it to another version of the model and see if it's performing better. And we're like, yeah, but how do we know we should be doing this model instead of something totally different? Like there does become a point where like the cost of maintaining it, whether it's to do with the volume of your data, whether it's to do with how often you have to update, whatever the case may be, even in an automated world, like there is a cost. And I sometimes feel like data has gotten away. Like I work with data teams all the time that are like, oh, there's no way to quantify our impact. And I'm like, but we're telling our stakeholders to do that. Like we have to be held to the same standard. And it's, I think a big part of this for me is that it has been easier to quantify the impact, right? Because you have something that the team have worked on, they've put together, and you can be like, it's reduced FTE, or it's, you know, it had a substantial impact on our foundational goal. Or like, I personally have found it's easier to tie it to, I guess, the business value.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a reasonable question to say, like, and I ask my team this, I'm like, where do you think we show up on the balance sheet and the income statement? Are we, like, honestly, it's a fairly, they don't love that question because they're like, well, I do science, not business. I'm like, well, your paycheck is definitely not signed by science, signed by a business. So I think it's an important question to ask, to say like, what is like responsible from a business standpoint to invest in? And like, in some cases, like this focus on data as a product, for me, it often shows up in the context of like, how can we be more responsible with what we're investing in, when we're investing in it, and like when we should deprecate it or get rid of it. It's not an easy question, but again, I think asking the question is pretty important.
So this may be stepping back a little bit, because I'm still a little confused of what we're talking about when we say data. I get that when we say a model, so that can be thought of as a product, but now it's kind of in the vernacular of like products and services. So like data as a service, and I think you had one. You did have an article where you were like, not everything to do with data should be considered a data product. But I guess I even get kind of wrapped up around the data products. So I think of things that are like these, you know, they're an application. There's something that is a thing that you can draw a box around and it can be product managed.
Yeah.
But there are times where data as a product, is that the same thing? And where does the service of performing ad hoc useful analyses that it needs a skilled analyst or a data scientist working with the stakeholder for a one-time thing, does that still fit in this world, or is that something separate?
No, I think it's separate. I think about things like analysts, consultants, whatever, we create a lot of useful assets. Those are like, I think those are more like one-time like reports, analyses, like here's what's true right now, here's how to think about this, here's why this metric is the right one to use in our business. And actually, like, those are really, really important and should not be like, you know, not everything should become a product, primarily because like businesses operate off of those like analyses, those discussions, those. And so those can be really, really valuable. Now, the question of like, how do you make something like that live on and continue to have business value? Maybe does that analysis need to be repeated? Do you want someone to be doing the repeating of it, or do you want that to be automated? That's maybe where you start talking about like a product. And a good question for me is, if I'm trying to define something as a product, I'm like, who's the customer? Like who's interacting with it, who's benefiting from it. And that often helps me try to think through that.
So in a way, kind of taking that work structure and going up a level and sort of saying like, yeah, that cadence of business interest analysis response is some sort of product itself in a way.
Yeah. Or it can, I mean, it can be. I think that's an important question of like really common for people to start when they're developing metrics to kind of hack together a query that is like, here's the metric definition. And if they know what they're doing, they can potentially implement that and actually put it into production so that it works at business scale. But like, do you want to make that easier, right? Do you want to make that layer accessible to a large group of people who are maybe not experts? Like, we have like a metrics layer and like metrics product internally that allows people to define and actually manage these definitions. And I think that's like an example of going from a one-off, let's get this thing so it works, to making it easier to do something and manage it over time.
And also just the reliability. Like for us, like we're starting to really talk about metrics, I guess, that you do want to productize or whatever you want to call it. And for me, it's also, are there core metrics across the business? And this does come back to that whole idea of a metrics layer, that you need reliability is a real issue. Like if it goes down for a day or two, is that going to be problematic versus like you running some code on your local machine and like churning out a report for one stakeholder and it's not going to be the end of the world if it's delayed by a day. That for me is like a big differentiator as well.
Yeah. I think experimentation is a good example because it tends to be a fairly high leverage use case. Like for my team, like experimentation platforms, certainly at Stitch Fix, every single piece of traffic goes through it, right? Because we have to decide what experience are you going to be exposed to. If the platform goes down or it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing, it essentially throws hundreds of experiments simultaneously into chaos and they're no longer reliable. Arguably, like if it goes down for 5 hours, it basically invalidates like a huge set of experiments. So like things like that, I think there's levels to like, you know, tier one, tier two, tier three type of systems. Metrics certainly are important. If they went down for an hour, like potentially it would be okay. But you start to get into these questions of like, how long can your business function without this thing working?
Well, so that's an experimentation platform in kind of this world that is presumably, whether it's homegrown or whether it's one that you've bought but you're managing, that is one class of data products.
Yeah.
Right? You just mentioned the metrics. Can you help me understand what like what product metrics data product is? Like,
I mean, in this case, I would think about it as like an interface that allows people to interact with metric definitions, health of that metric, lineage of how that metric has been defined over time. So in some cases, there are certainly third-party tools that do it. For me, it's like people are actually able to interact with, understand, and explore like those metric definitions. It's not just the like management layer, the where you're actually defining the ETL, but you start to actually expose it to other like customers internally. That would be an example.
So that could be a data product that the analyst may be using as they're doing ad hoc services, but it's also tied into some self-service tools that a business user, like, so that's like it's a multi-use, and it's got to figure out, back to your who's the customer, like,
yeah,
treating it with who's the customer, where's the value this is delivering, and then product managing the data product.
I think that is really important to just think about, like, who's benefiting or who do we want to benefit from this thing, right? Because if you don't answer that question, it's really hard to build something effectively and actually even decide how much to invest in it, when should we invest in it. Like for large, I mean, arguably for small data science teams, the difference between like if you have five people versus hundreds, that probably shifts what you're prioritizing in a pretty major way, just from a company standpoint. Because you got to also ask, like, what's right for the company as you're thinking about who benefits from this.
So what are the other, I feel like we're starting to tease out. I remember Mo presented this list, but I think she totally lifted it from you is like different types of data products, and we just hit a couple of them. Do you rattle off like the types of data products you see out there is
so
off the top of your head?
I think I have there's like a danger of saying the word analytics, but there's enough like products that purport to be like analytics products that I think it's worth talking about at least. So if you think, I mean, analytics is such a broad area, but like one would be like a data visualization layer. It's like, how do you want to enable people to interact with the data that you have, the metrics you've defined, experiment results? So I think like UIs often are like, you know, if they are enabling people to interact with data and actually like, this is like maybe more on the decision layer, that's really important. Like how you design these, how you create these. I'm going to bash Looker here for a second. I hate it. I hate their UI layer. In particular, like if I think about it, it's like, how do you enable people to get to what they're thinking about and to actually like think more deeply about the data there? And I think products across like sit across that spectrum, like who they're trying to do it for and how easy it is to use. So analytics is the UI layer. And then I feel like we're going to get into controversial, like what is analytics and what is it not? Super quick.
We've never like, shied away. That's why we're top rated explicit analytics podcast.
It's so I think the next, like the other one that's probably really relevant to talk about is just like ML related products, just because I think they're probably a good illustration of how do you make ML, like even beyond what machine learning engineers need, how do you like expose layers of ML and models to people in a business so that they can like make sense of it? We have one of the teams in my organization is called our algorithm UI team, and we literally just build UIs so that we can think about how to enable people to interact with our recommendation systems. One of those is like personalized style. So we have like this huge visualization layer that's just called like, basically it allows people to visualize in three dimensions, like what is someone's style and how are we measuring it? And so I think for ML, especially because it can become so complex so quickly, there's like a huge number, like huge opportunities to build these products that allow people to make sense of things that otherwise, like even 5 years ago, would have been really challenging to interact with.
I mean, just the ML platform. So there's the making sense of what comes out, but is it also, the explosion of startups that are pretty much auto ML, you know, throw your data in.
See, yeah,
and
I've
we'll
always
do it for oh, you.
See, I've always thought of it more as like an actual pipeline so that ML engineers can push their models back to the product, but maybe I've totally misinterpreted this one.
No, I don't think
depends on who the customer is.
Arguably the word platform is like a horrible word because it typically, like even within experimentation, you probably have sub products that you can fairly easily define. Like similar for machine learning, right? You go back to like, who's the customer for people like, people who are benefiting and need to understand what these models are doing, that could potentially be one group. For ML engineers who are just trying to make sure they have stable and reliable pipelines that are like feeding back and forth to the product, that's another entire class of these things. And so I think what I've learned and probably what I should start doing more often is to just try to not use the word platform.
Good luck. I feel like I say it like 12 times a day.
Platform is just this, like the image of it makes it seem so much cleaner and well-defined than it ever is. Like saying, oh, we have this platform thing, but it's like, what makes it up? What makes up that platform? And I think for data products, that probably without like saying the word platform probably hides a lot of that complexity when it's actually like a bunch of different things that make it up.
Do you know the funniest thing is, like, as you were saying this, I was thinking, so the one, like, for anyone that has heard me talk about this, I have taken some of Eric's ideas and adapted them very selfishly for my own purposes. And one of the additions that I've made is a measurement platform. But as you were talking about this, I was like, does measurement platform fit in? Because it's not really one tool. It's actually like a suite of tools that we use for measurement. And now I'm like, the problem is just that I'm using the word platform, which implies that it's one thing when it isn't. It's actually like five or six totally separate tools, and we
what is a measurement platform do? I mean, what are those five or six or three or four? Like, is that the collection of the data? Is
we have an MMM, we have an experimentation tool like a match market test, then we have like brand health surveys and panels, we have causal inference tool that we use, and I'm forgetting, and then we have a reporting interface. So it's like there's actually there like five totally separate data products, if you will. Some of them are in-house, some of them we have bought, but ultimately the goal is that that suite of tools tells us how we're performing from a measurement perspective.
Something that brings up for me is the people who are designing these products might think about this very differently than the people who are actually interacting with them. Like, if you want, I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, I want to give someone like an easy way in to doing these things. And like, I don't want them to think about the design decisions or like how these things fit together. I just want them to do things, right? For experimentation, especially, I don't want them to have to think about how many multiple things we're trying to bring together. I want them to log in, be able to see something and like make a choice or understand a trade-off as efficiently as they can. And so the design is different than the experience, which I think is pretty, which is pretty important.
But it, I mean, is that, that's kind of getting at the reason that I would, you know, Looker, Adobe Analysis Workspace, Google Analytics 4 Explorer, like you name your tool, they, when it's a third party, they're kind of definitionally trying to design the interface for a very broad and deep, like their business model is they have to appeal to a broad set of people. So it's, it almost feels like there's a, once you hit a certain level of scale of an organization, it can start tilting on from the data product perspective, it can start tilting you to the more of the build versus buy, or maybe you buy components, but asking that question, who is our customer within Canva or within Stitch Fix? Which customer are we trying to serve, and probably being a little more diligent that the data scientist is a different persona than the marketer. And so you can have a little more control over, is this one product serving both with different interfaces? Is it two product? Like it just, it feels like I used to make a joke. It's a terrible joke, but I'll make it anyway, that like it's pretty easy. The only, like, everybody wants, it's pretty simple what people want from their analytics platform. They want a clear, simple, intuitive, easy to use interface that gives them access to all of the data. Like, great, not possible, because the,
I thought you were gonna say they want certainty, and I was like or a soapbox, you know.
Well, that too, I guess that's this yeah. other piece. Like when you started to say you don't want them to have to think how all the nuts and bolts of what's connected, like I struggle with like wanting some friction, because it is, it's to that point too. They're like, well, I just want this to give me the answer. And you started, Eric, by talking about like causality. I'm like, well, if somebody's wading into one of these data products and they don't understand some basic intuition around causation and uncertainty, where do they have to pick that? Can the tool add some friction and forced education, or is that a totally separate beast? I'm sure that's a simple answer.
I think the tool, I think friction is good. It's just a question of like, do you want to make it really obvious? So for experimentation, people log in and look at experiment results. Like, we explicitly introduce a cost to adding additional metrics. We adjust confidence intervals significantly, like what counts as significant as you're adding metrics. Like, we make you pay for it in the product, right? You don't get anything for free, which is again, that's arguably pretty heavy-handed, but the alternative is that people show up with 70 metrics from an experiment and like, look, this is directionally positive, which creates tons of chaos and churn and swirl. So I think within like that specific space, I think it's possible to make some design decisions. Within analytics, though, to your point, people want to hunt around for something that seems like, hey, this seems plausible. Here's my story and my narrative. Let me carry it forward from here.
I love the idea of the tool forcing trade-offs, like teaching trade-offs by saying you have to.
It's like the Hunger Games for data. I'm like really into it.
What that says to me is no matter how good of a product you create, there are still going to be plenty of people willing to use it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just part of it. But I think it's a discipline that a lot of people, when they sit down to like do these exercises, don't think, or they don't really put their product management hat on, which I kind of think is what we're talking about a lot.
Yeah.
And sort of like, yeah, how do we want to enable this, or what behaviors are a good priority for us in designing this versus we need to address and help corral sort of the wrongy thinking, this need for certainty that people might want on the business side because of the, you know, increasing cost curve that it creates in terms of the data.
Yeah. The thing that I struggle with the most with anything like this is people, if they are using any of these products, they probably have some preconceived narrative of what's true and what's not. And it's really hard to disrupt the narrative that people have mostly decided to operate by. And so that often produces, like within analytics platforms especially, it produces like they go on the hunt for things that fit the narrative and kind of explain away things that don't. And I think that is one of the hardest parts, is like people want to simplify like the story to a degree that makes it easy to share. And like these products, like I don't know how to design them in a way that like breaks some of that.
But isn't that the point?
The cognitive bias corrective data product?
Honestly, that we probably just got $10 million in valuation and funding for this.
That's a machine learning product that finds you the metrics that put your idea in the best possible light.
People just throwing money.
We could get so much money. Yeah.
But isn't that the... Okay, so the thing I most wanted to talk about, and I'm like really conscious, I want to turn the conversation in that direction, is like that is the role of your embedded analysts, right? Like no data product is going to fix that problem because that is an inherent problem of just like people's biases. That's what your embedded analyst should do. And actually, everyone will have to indulge me in a short anecdote. But one of the things that I have been talking about, and actually when I talked about this at Marketing Analytics Summit, I hadn't actually reached this conclusion yet. I was still in the like, how do we get everyone from like data as a service to data products? And the truth is like, I've really evolved my thinking there due to Eric, where that isn't actually the goal. The goal is not to move your whole team from data as a service to data products, because in my mind, data service was very reactive and data products is proactive because you're thinking about the future, you're thinking about the long-term problems of the organization that you need to solve. But Eric, can you share a little bit about what your embedded statisticians do and like at Stitch Fix and how that works to support the data products? Because this is the bit that like over the last couple of weeks has blown my mind.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's so there's product design, but also like there's organizational design that has to like reinforce. If you want these products to do what you want them, like what they should, you have to have the organization set up around it. So if you don't have really thoughtful senior people who are trying to incentivize and generate behaviors and like ways of approaching problems that are then like potentially reinforced by the products you have, you're just going to create tools on one side and people on the other, and people are going to get an entirely different experience and set of expectations if they don't reinforce each other. So the idea of like, you know, it's really common to have a consulting model where people just kind of go where they're needed, and it's like, cool, we're doing the right thing for the business. But then it like, how do you translate some of what they're doing into like these repeatable, scalable capabilities? I think that's really hard to do because they often have like context knowledge, specific understanding of people and time and place and politics, I guess, is another thing to throw in there. You're not going to put that into a product. And so it's like, for me, it's an org design thing too, for leaders to be like, how should we set up this organization and what should we build alongside people so that we actually have this function? I think that's really hard to do. For us, it works because we have super senior people who are doing most of the consulting. And so they like work very closely and try to incentivize the right behaviors that our products also try to support.
And I think the thing that I just love about this approach is that you're really elevating the role of the embedded data practitioners, because it's about them answering the most complicated questions that a data product can't answer, because for various reasons, like they're just too complex to build some kind of automated product around it. And so what you're actually doing is you're making the work of those embedded folks super interesting, because as we started to like move towards this approach and we did set up some data product teams, they were doing all the cool shit. And I really felt for the embedded data folks because they're kind of like, oh, those people get to work on the fun stuff and I'm answering like these random stakeholder questions. And now it's been really amazing to take the team through. Yeah, but the point is they're going to automate and build solutions for the boring shit. Like, what can we automate or what can we take off your to-do list that we don't need to spend analyst time on so you can answer the really interesting questions? And for me, that has been like this huge light bulb. Just like it's really invigorated me.
Yeah, I mean, that is something I wish we could get more right. And maybe it came from just because data science is matured kind of after some like engineering organizations have. It's like, what do you have your most senior engineers doing, right? Like, they're certainly deciding that we should invest in like something scalable and reusable, but they're also like probably tackling like the thorniest and weirdest and hardest problems that still matter. Whereas like, you know, senior engineers are definitely builders. They can make things that are really powerful for a company. But it's also like, if you look at really senior people, they're able to like actually navigate fairly complex areas that are not well understood enough to even build a product around. And I think it's like defining, what does it even mean to be a senior analyst? That's a hard problem and like something that I don't think like we've probably spent a ton of time on, which is like, there's a lot of these staff, senior staff, principal archetypes for engineering. We have not fleshed that out in the same way for data. That is certainly true. Long way off.
Is there, I guess, Mo, the risk or the challenge? Like I'm really intrigued by the customer centric aspect of the data product side, that we don't just build, because I feel like that's a huge suck of value, is the jump to build product. We'll stand up the BI tool or we'll build you the dashboard, and there's the risk that it's like, I'm just trying to shed manual repetitive stuff, and it becomes the goal is I'm doing this repetitive thing. I want to shed the repetitive thing. It winds up in some form of a data product, and nowhere in that handoff or continuum is anyone saying, wait a minute, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Where's the value? And it seems like on the analyst doing the service, if they're good, and Eric, even as you're talking about, like a good analyst is going to say, I may be able to hack together and kind of automate some stuff. I'm basically building a product prototype, but I may not have the discipline to actually do the customer assessment. So it feels like there's kind of a slippery slope, and I'm probably guilty of it in a small way, where I'm like, sure, I'll hack this thing together with Excel or R or something, and then say, great, I've proven that this works. and people like it. So now let's go build it. And it becomes a data product. And somehow that just manages to miss the whole validation of, is this useful? Like, does that make sense? Like, is that a...
I think the issue is, like, in that process you just described, there is a step missing. That's like, is this valuable?
Yeah.
Right? And, like,
but it,
if you have...
Yeah.
Like, so...
But the challenge, if I may say, is this valuable? And I show it to a customer and they're like, yeah, that's cool. I want that. And that's not doing the step. That's making you... That's like the feeling like you did the step because it was pretty and they liked it.
But we all know you can't literally listen to your stakeholders. They're going to ask... Like, they're not always asking for the right shit.
That's like asking someone, like, would you like some insights? Sure. Of course they would like
it. Yeah.
Like, everyone wants some insights and they want more of them. Like, that's where having that question of, like, asking them for their opinion and approval is often not going to, like, get you, because then you're just end up with a lot of pretty graphs and not much else. Instead of saying, like, what do you want them to do? Like, what choices do you want them to trade off on? Like, for experimentation, this is pretty explicit. We, like, limit the number of metrics they can look at intentionally because we want them to, like, force that question of, like, what is important to us? And it has to come at the expense of something else.
In essence, you need to conduct your own user research, right? And
yes.
And drive into not just sort of like, you know, oh yeah, this will give you insights, but what insights are you getting? What are the top five actions you're taking? Or if you had this, what would that enable for you? And almost, I think that's where a lot of teams, like, you know, we're all bashing Looker this time. So, like, we'll just keep picking on it. But, like, a lot of...
I tried to spread it out a little bit, okay. But no, if you don't want to go there with me.
The affiliate sponsorship has gone away.
We'll use Google Data Studio.
No, mode.
Whatever. You name it, whatever it is, the problem is it gets built once and then never enters a product lifecycle type of structure, right, where we're adapting and are in a back and forth iterative feedback loop that helps us enable enhancements to, in that case, the UI layer, right, that you described in terms of, like, the layers of the products that analytics would encompass.
I feel like those tools, I mean, they do. They have product managers who are talking to customers, figuring out what they need. I mean,
I totally disagree. I've got, like, thousands of dashboards that are sitting there, and it drives me absolutely bonkers.
No.
Oh, sorry.
But the dashboard enabling technology, I'm making the distinction.
It's not the technology. It's the interface between reports come in and out of use. Like, they start out potentially useful, but then fade as companies grow in sophistication or asking different questions or the business cycle pivots. All kinds of reasons why a report will just not be useful anymore.
But that's exactly why.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Data as products, like, makes sense because this is a concept
that's
from product
what
that
I'm
we
trying
can
to
steal.
Say.
Yeah.
But that's, like, what I think we're not doing as analytics teams very much of, which is having those conversations and kind of, like, spending the time to do that work. Honestly, I don't think we're even given that time a lot of times. Like, nobody's like, oh, do you need time to figure this out? It's like, no, there's 40 bajillion other requests they'd like you to work on. And most data teams become order takers and they're just pulling down orders and trying to answer them like short order cooks all the time and just trying to, you know, get stuff out of the kitchen as fast as possible. And that's no way to live. We all know that. But it's hard to kind of...
That's exactly what we need to shift.
Yeah, make the shift.
For example, our team now review dashboards every 3 to 6 months, and we actually look at who's looked at them. And if people haven't looked them, we put them in a deprecated folder for 6 months. And if they're still there 6 months later, we're deleting them. Like,
but back to Mo, your point, like, if there is a data product that is this is how we produce and deliver dashboards, and however that's built, if it doesn't also provide visibility into who is accessing and using them, like, not in every case. That generally seems like a great feature. And there are generally digital analytics platforms that make that very hard or impossible. And they definitely have heard that from their customers. And they definitely aren't incentivized to provide data on how people are not using the products that are created with their platform. So, but I think there's a level of, if like detecting things that aren't being used, and sometimes you just say, it probably, you know what, these things naturally tend to have a life cycle of 6 to 18 months. This one's probably at the end of it. Let's just kill it. That's natural. Versus, wait a minute, we're 2 months in and no one's using it. That feels like we may need to go back to our customer and say, we think we must have missed the mark. Can we go back to our understanding of what you were trying to do? It goes back to the customer.
But can I just harp on one last soapbox? I promise this is my last soapbox for the episode. One of the things that I'm really chatting to the team about now that I love about adopting ideas from other disciplines, product is all about an iterative process. And I think data folks are so obsessed with this idea of like, a stakeholder has asked for a dashboard. I'm going to build out wireframes. I'm going to double check it's what they want. And then we're going to go away. I'm going to build the most perfect dashboard. It's going to have all 42 metrics they want by 5 different filters with yada, yada, yada. And it's like, product, the thing that we want to learn from product is like, no, this should be about iteration. You build them the skateboard first. So you say, what are the 5 most important metrics? You build that first. You go back. You check they're using it. Are they still using it? Great. You add another 6 or whatever the case is, right? And like that process that we can adopt from product is like, for me, part of the genius of this. It's like stopping us from seeking perfection.
I'll play the old guy card again. Like that's literally where the consensus was 20 years ago of where data was. Because data, I mean, it was very similar. Data warehouses, they threw traditional developers at it and they wanted to use kind of a waterfall development methodology, get all of the requirements, spend 6 months developing it, roll it out. People are like, this is great. Used it once. By the way, the business has moved on. It doesn't have this new metric and they didn't use it. And so I just very clearly remember this kind of epiphany of like, oh no, a data warehouse, which is definitely like a monolithic data product, I think, needs to be living and iterating and not just growing in complexity. So I agree 100%.
Shit, but how did that happen?
I don't know. I'm drunk.
I think it's interesting that like he argued about which internal product affects more people's decisions on a daily basis. I asked someone this internally.
Ooh.
They were like, the org chart. That's it.
Oh my God.
That affects more people's decisions about what to do and how to interact and how, and honestly, we went and looked at like on our platforms, we control like, pretty much we can see what everyone accesses. The org chart is by and far, by like a factor of 10x, the most accessed thing. It's insane.
I've had clients that don't have their org charts like readily available, and it drives
it's insane. People,
it drives everyone crazy.
Yeah. It is the most commonly trafficked page in nearly any company.
But so, Eric, what is the purpose of asking that question? Like, how do you use that with the team?
I was just curious from a like, I mean, if you think about the idea that you're arguing that like people are going to reuse something and come back to it, I'm like, why would you come back to something? Like in this case, they're coming back to it because they're trying to figure out who does this person report to, who owns this thing, I want something to happen, who do I go to? Like, it's not the same thing as, you know, looking at a metric, but I'm trying to more think about like what causes people to come back to something habitually. Like, at LinkedIn, it was interesting because our VP plus team would get this dashboard sent to them on the hour, every hour of every day. That was basically, how is the product functioning? It was like essentially an executive dashboard that popped to their email at the top of every hour.
Every hour.
And every hour.
Who made the decision of every hour?
Come on. Like, come on. It was LinkedIn. Clearly no one was looking at it or acting on it.
They were just like, they wanted it every single hour. And like, it's fascinating to think about just like the scale of it, because they would notice things that were weird and they would ask a lot of questions. And once they get used to seeing something regularly, honestly, the org chart's probably a good example. If I go to a company that doesn't have an org chart, I'm like, I don't know how to function. Who do I talk to? What am I supposed to do? Who do you report to? I don't know who to talk to, so I would lose it. Like,
do you matter?
Yeah, do you matter? Like exactly where do you fall on the workday org chart? Workday. Anyway, I'm going to not bash another company.
Yeah. Well, it's fine. They're not a sponsor. So, no. Okay, we do have to start to wrap up, but it was worth waiting for that bombshell because that was outstanding. So thank you for that little last piece, Eric, because that rang really true. All right, we do have to start to wrap up, which has just been such a great conversation. But one of the things we like to do is go around the horn and share something that we think might be of interest for our listeners. We call it our last call. So, Eric, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
Yeah, so I think like product management, it's fascinating. It's like people, universities continue to want people like to teach about this, and then they run into it. Like, there's no rigor on how it's defined. They're like, what the hell is product? Like, how do I teach a course on this? So I really admire like newsletters, and I think people that are trying to at least take those ideas apart. Will Lawrence, who used to be at Meta and is now, he's moved on, has a newsletter called Product Life. It's on Substack and it's very popular. And I think the reason is that it actually gives structure to thinking about product. Like, you know, frameworks are all mostly wrong to some degree, but I think it really helps give a tangible idea of like, okay, what is product management? How do these different companies think about it? How does it, like, how do I actually be productive in this type of role? I just find it really useful. I think it's it makes things tangible to a point where you can actually discuss them instead of just getting lost kind of like in generalities and hand wavy statements. So really admire it. I think it's really hard to write in the first place, but he's built up like a really solid community of people. And I tend to learn from the things that he writes. So I think that's a useful one.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Nice.
All right. Mo, what about you? Do you have a last call to share?
I do, but I can't vouch for it yet because it's a recent discovery and I've only listened to part of one episode, but it's actually got me really excited and I'm going to be downloading a bunch of them to listen to on the plane. There is a
poor form to be listening to that first part while you're recording this one, but
yeah. I'm that good at multitasking too. It's called Making Sense of MarTech, and it's an irregular set of interviews. I think the reason that I got really excited about it is because it's obviously this intersection of marketing and technology, and like, I don't actually feel like there's a crazy amount of people that are talking about this space. Like, it tends to be like a marketing podcast that does an episode on something to do that's relative to tech or whatever the case is. So I started to have a listen to the episode about the privacy winter. There's some about like the tech behind attribution and that sort of stuff. So that's why I'm super pumped. And I will keep you updated on how I find the episodes.
Nice. Thank you. All right, Tim, what about you? What's your last call?
So I'll start. It's in the very near term, but CXL Live is next week in Ooh. Austin. So I will be there for part of that. Michael will be in the vicinity.
Oh, it's right. Such a fun conference.
If you're heading to Austin for the F1 race at the Circuit of the Americas, it's immediately following the F1 race. So I expect to see Danny Ricciardo talking optimization in Austin. But
are you presenting, Tim?
I'm leading some discussion groups.
Oh,
so,
it's such a good conference. I love that one.
So yeah, so it's short notice, but I'm pretty sure you can still get there. And if not, if you're already planning to be there, then I'll look forward to seeing you. Please stop by, say hi. I'll have some podcast stickers.
Hey.
Maybe other swag.
You can't get those just anywhere.
F1,
yeah,
models.
That's right.
Yeah. What about you, Michael?
So recently I ran across a blog post by a company called Count, and apparently they're working on a new product. So we were talking about data products and things like this, and then it sort of was like, oh, that brought to mind this post I read. So they've been trying to figure out how to integrate decision making and the UI of data and reporting. And so they've come up with this Canvas type approach, which I described to my team internally as like Miro for data, which some of my team was like, oh, that sounds awful. But it actually is kind of an interesting concept. I don't know where it'll go, and I don't know where it actually can be useful, but I found it quite interesting, and we'll put a link to it on the website, so if you were interested in something like that. But it's kind of cool how they're trying to let companies have everyone participate in the discussion about the data and the decisions being made in a real-time environment or a collaborative environment. And I thought that was at least an interesting attempt to solve some of the problems we were talking about even on this episode. So anyway.
It's called Count?
Yeah, it's Count. Count.co.
And two episodes ago, you, I believe, if I recall right, your last call was equals? Like,
I think so.
Are you fucking with us?
No, I just pay attention to what's going on in the industry.
Okay, it's going to be some.co. Next time. I don't know.
Well, you know, okay. They're not cool like us with the .io, but, you know, it's fine.
Okay.
Anyways, that's my last call, and we'll just we'll put a little editorial lens on yours in the future too, Tim. How about?
I'm just seeing a pattern. I'm going to set up a data product to do a little text mining on the.
That's perfect. All right. Well, I'll make sure to throw a couple of nothing more I love than to disrupt a pattern. So, challenge accepted. All right. Well, one thing that's definitely been a pattern was how awesome this conversation has been. So, Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing some insights with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And as listeners, you're probably wondering, where can I learn more? How can I participate in this conversation? Well, as luck would have it, Eric has an excellent newsletter, which we did mention earlier, but I'd highly recommend subscribing. Which I have, and you can read a lot of his thoughts there. Are there other places where you're active, Eric, on social media, like on many other places, or is that best way for people?
LinkedIn a little bit, but I've primarily shifted to just trying to write newsletters. I have more time to think through things.
So. Excellent. So that's the best place, and we'll put a link to that on the site as well. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us on the Measure Slack group or on Twitter, or on our LinkedIn page. So if you've got questions, comments, or anything like that, we'd love to hear from you. And of course, no show is complete without a massive thank you to Josh Crowhurst, our producer, for everything he does to make this show happen. So thank you, Josh. All right. I know that as you're listening to this, you're going to be thinking, how am I going to manage all of these things in my day-to-day and become a product manager as well as an analyst, as well as a data scientist, as well as a machine learning expert? Well, there's one thing I know I can say with confidence from both of my co-hosts, Tim and Mo, as you figure out what your future job title should be, just remember one thing, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
This is the thing. The three layers, you can pick which way you want to go. Because most people don't remember how hard it was to use data in Tableau, which Tableau, I think, gives you one of the most beautiful.
I'm still a deep Tableau lover. I don't care how complicated it is. I still
visually, love it. It is sort of like at the top, I think, for a lot of people. But for many years, you had to do so much work to put your data in a way that you could actually get it in there.
Yeah.
And the companies that simplified that on the other end of like, hey, we get your data in and manipulate it really easily, never had the work done to get the visualization piece super slick. And so you just...
That's why
it's trade-offs.
GGPot, it's so intuitive.
Hobbs, what beverage are you drinking?
This is an iced coffee, so I'm just
in a
mason jar because I'm from the South.
Cool, you're hip.
Mm-hmm. It's just
vodka.
Is it actually?
It's got a little...
No, I didn't think so. You're also trying to be cool.
No, I just had leftover coffee.
We've aged on this podcast. When we started recording it, we literally always had a drink.
Yeah, we would always have like a cool beer or a whiskey or something. Like, and now it's like, well, some water's nice.
We're too old for that.
Hydration.
Back in my 2017 self could handle that and work the next day.
We had a couple episodes where we had to flip the time because of Europe, which meant that I could drink, and that never ended well because I would be on the show like a few glasses of wine deep after a big day at work, and it just, we had to keep me on the morning schedule. But mostly it's me saying stupid stuff, like, let's be real, because Tim knows when he's hit the record button, so he always says his stupid shit before.
Tim is always trying to catch us saying something damaging. All right.
It's usually you saying something damaging. I'm like, crap, I need to be recording, so I'll hit record and hopefully you do it again. I feel like you're refuting something that I did not remotely say. Michael, on the other hand, said, we don't get given time to do this.
But you have to make time.
Which is a complete load of crap, and we had an episode on that.
Yeah.
That I'm going to react to separately, but I have no idea what
Bo you're notice myself saying it exactly like that, Tim. That's fascinating.
I'm just being triggered by our owning versus helping.
Yeah, that's fine. And remember, Tim, there's a couple of differences as it pertains to you specifically, because as the quintessential analyst...
Because I'm a jackass?
People listen to you when you walk into a room. I mean, you have, like, this command and respect and authority that, like, others of us in the industry just don't possess. And so, you know, that's one of those things.
You're such an asshole.
Thank you. All right.
Poor Eric is like, what the fuck am I signed up for?
Eric is like, do you?
After the meeting, like, honestly, the stuff that we're saying here, like, I wish this could translate to actual business meetings where people are like, yeah, you generally are full of shit about this thing. And we should just, like, everyone knows it in the room. But it's just like, it's
cool. Yeah.
Rock flag and Looker's amazing.
Oh, wow. Doubled down on that one.
Yeah, really did.
I figured, what the heck.